Welcome to the All of a Kind podcast. I'm Batya Wittenberg.
And I'm Mirav Hoffman.
We loved these books when we were kids. We love them now, and we hope you do too.
Today's episode is part two of the chapter where the family prepares for the Sabbath. And in keeping with that, we are providing you with a double portion.
In the first half of the chapter, Mama took all the girls to market with her on a Thursday afternoon. We pick up in the second half on Friday afternoon, with the girls going to the library before Sabbath starts. They entertain Miss Ellen with an account of their market adventures, and then rush home to bring in the Sabbath, welcome Papa home from synagogue, and enjoy the peace of a companionable Friday night at home.
Now, where were we? You know, Miss Allen's like, oh, tell us all about your adventures in the market, because that's like a big raucous thing that they're doing. And then we get into the quiet of Shabbat.
We use the library as a transitional space twice in this chapter.
That's, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
There's something there.
The girls get shushed in the library by the other librarians as they're acting out their shenanigans in the market.
That we have this little thing here, which is going to be significant later, that Ella's a good actress and does impressions.
Nice little
that
call
is
out.
Significant foreshadowing.
Yes.
But Henny also does impressions because she goes in the market and
she imitates the chickpea vendor. That's right. Arabis Shane, like a good thing.
I also love the Yiddish inflected English that you hear from the peddler.
Yes.
Leave her alone, lady. She's helping me in my business. If you have a grandparent of a certain generation, you know what that sounds like.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
We also got this with the candy store owner a chapter or two back. For less than half a penny, I can't sell. And like,
yes.
I can hear the,
right. Cadence, exactly.
The cadence.
That's music
it.
I understand without having to be explained to me.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes. If you were reading this and you weren't an Ashkenazi Jew, it's a completely foreign set of phonemes. So as you're parsing that out in your brain as you read, will you hear the same thing we're
no.
hearing? Probably not.
No. Whenever you have a phonetically, or not even phonetically, but just faithfully word-for-word transcribed accent that you're not already familiar with, I am remembering when I read The Lord of the Rings as a kid, and I did not have any exposure to the sort of lower-class rural accent that's Sam Gamgee is supposed to speak in. Something about his choice of words, his speech patterns, made my brain parse his accent as vaguely Texan.
Which isn't incorrect, because the southern sound is actually very close to some of the rural British sounds.
That's the reason that some of the speech patterns are the same, that it's literally derived from rural English.
In anime dubs, they will use
I was just gonna bring this up
American
too.
Southern accents to replace rural Japanese accents.
So that we get the right vibe for the hearer.
It's the vibe. It's also, frankly, the same American classism that we...
Yes, exactly. What accent is going to sound to the hearer like a person who has these or the equivalent of these regional and class markers?
Right.
And that works.
And it's often the slower speech pattern that is laconic, drawling, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
So I do wonder if you have no exposure at all to Yiddish-inflected English, what do these faithfully reproduced speech patterns sound like?
I would be interested too. The one thing I thought was really interesting about this chapter is, as Terry says, there are these two library sequences, one where they're under Mama's supervision, mm-hmm. and one where they're back at the library on Friday alone, the way that they would be on a normal Friday, and they're actually acting up because they're having this very animated discussion with Miss Allen to the point where the other librarians notice and shush them. Mm-hmm. And then the girls pretend to slink away, right? They just kind of like do this like sheepish, like, oh, we're going to leave, but we had so much fun. It's one of the places where we get to see them being kids.
Yes.
And their enthusiasm for the market is still with them because this was such a special thing for them to do that they have to share it with Miss Allen, who has already asked them, has given them permission to be themselves in front of her and tell me all about your adventure. And then from there, we go directly home. And I found this a little weird. This is not what I grew up with, but they come running home and Mama's already blessing the candle, right? The girls are not blessing the candles with Mama because they're not of age, right? None of them, I mean, there is no bat mitzvah at this point. They're girls, right? There is no bat mitzvah for quite a long
time. They're in the home, so it's assumed that Mama will be doing it until they are married themselves and in homes of their own, because at this point, the assumption that they would be in a home of their own without a husband is not there.
It is not assumed to be likely, and if that happens, it is assumed to be a grave misfortune.
It's also interesting to me that while she lights more than two, she only lights four.
Four count?
Huh. Yeah, that was really interesting to me as
well.
That's
very weird, because I can understand lighting two from economy or not having the familial tradition to light one for all of your children, because that's not universal. But to light four but not light seven is weird for me.
That is odd.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it was some kind of familial tradition in the family.
It could be.
Or is she lighting two candles for someone else, right? Like, is there someone that she knows isn't lighting, so she's lighting them
for
that
person? Or the two represent all of the children. It's different.
I'll tell you, if there is somebody for whom she's lighting two candles because there's no candles being lit at their house, my bet is it's Uncle Hyman.
Mm.
That's very possible, actually.
Who lives alone and isn't married.
Could be.
Right, and he may not have the tradition. And we'd have to look at a subsequent chapter once Uncle Hyman meets his future wife, which, spoiler, that's a romantic arc for a different book.
I was going to say, that's like not till the second or the third book. We're not there yet.
Exactly. We're not there yet. If Mama continues to light four candles at that point, she does have an unmarried brother, so that might be it. Or it might just be that Mama only has two sets of candlesticks.
That could be too.
I'm sure there's both Doylist and Watsonian explanations for why Mama is lighting four candles. It's just...
I can think of one other explanation.
Okay.
There is one tradition that says when you begin lighting Sabbath candles, when you first get into your own household, or if you do it as a child when you become bat mitzvah, you light two. If ever in your life you miss lighting the Shabbos candles, you add one. If you ever light from now on, you light three. If you miss another time from now on, you light four. I've heard it said that the reason that some people have the tradition of you add a candle for every child is that it is extraordinarily likely that in the first week of having a newborn child, you are going to miss lighting candles at least once.
That's fair.
So just beat the rush and add a candle as a default.
And while I'm noticing things that are different from how my family does things, mm-hmm. he blesses them before he goes to shul.
Yes.
That is so different.
We always had the blessing of the children after the Shalom Aleichem prayer and
before Kiddush.
So in this text, we have Papa saying Eshet Chayil, which is the, I can't really call it a blessing. It's a song, basically, mm-hmm. about the virtues of his wife, right? It's taken directly from Psalms. It's literally, how wonderful is my wife?
No, it's not in this chapter.
Uh-huh.
It is.
Where?
Papa washed his hands. It was right after he comes back in from shul. He says, good Shabbos. Everybody says, good Shabbos. They say, good Sabbath here. It was time for supper, but first he must pronounce the prayer in praise of his wife for her fine Sabbath preparations.
Ah, okay, yes.
Then
okay.
He must say a prayer of thanksgiving for the Sabbath, and that's the Kiddush.
That's Kiddush, right.
The recitation of Shalom Aleichem doesn't seem to be part of this, whether that wasn't their tradition or they just skipped it.
It's not in there. It might just be too many layers.
Yeah. Okay, interestingly, I'm wondering if the illustration, them all sitting around the table with a four-branched mm-hmm. candelabra, and maybe she just lights
what there's room for,
and she wants to light as many candles as possible.
Because they use that for light.
Because there's no electricity in their house. They can't leave a light on in the front room, you know, the way we might do now, where, you know, I leave my living room light on all weekend.
But this is actually mentioned in the last of the chapter. It says that when they're reading, the only light is coming from the Sabbath candles.
Right.
And there could be no light struck on the Sabbath. That was the law, which is just this really stark ending to the chapter.
It really is.
It's specific that we now have, depending on how long the candles are, a four-hour window of light between Papa goes to synagogue, we've lit the candles, we've said the blessings, Papa's going off to synagogue, and now when everybody is gathering in the living room after dinner to read, which is a whole sequence that we get in here, the candles are burning down. When the candles burn down, they're going to be in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they have to kind of watch that and make sure that they get to bed safely, because they can't take a candle with them to bed to make sure that, you know, stuff. And there's no heat, right? Like, unless Mama stuck irons in the beds before the Sabbath, which is unlikely, they're going to bed cold. So they're going from a brightly lit room into a dimmer room into the dark. And that's very stark. And I wonder if that's why the chapter ends in this very strange way. There could be no light struck on the Sabbath. That was the law.
That while the Sabbath is lovely and calm and peaceful, there's also a degree of very sober strictness about it.
Exactly.
That it's not just for enjoyment. It's also...
Which is going to interestingly come up much, much later. I don't remember which book it's in. The first time Papa goes to what I'm pretty sure is supposed to be a Reform synagogue.
Oh, yes.
And
he's got feelings about it. He's got big feelings about it.
He's got so many big feelings about that. All the family has big feelings about it.
What kind of rabbi is that? He doesn't even have a beard.
Right, and we'll certainly get there, but absolutely, Papa comes from a traditional rabbinical tradition.
Yes.
Like, we know about Morris Brenner that his fathers and grandfathers and what have you were all rabbis. So absolutely, this is going to offend him. This is not how it's done.
The family, before their exposure to this other way of being Jewish, their experience of Shabbat is both wonderful because they eat better, because they have time.
Rest and peace.
And they have time together in ways that they don't during the week. They eat on nicer...
And Papa is going to be home.
On nicer tablecloth, nicer dishes.
And the candelabra instead of the oil lamp. Mm-hmm. They have a tablecloth.
There's still this understanding that Shabbat is also a day of rules. That Shabbat... Yes. That there are things we may not do, and that's something that has to be conveyed to the reader who might not know what Shabbat looks like from the inside. I know what Shabbat looks like from the inside, but again, I am not the sole target audience of this book.
And that's why I find it so jarring when the girls come home. They're in their effectively street clothes, right? They're in their coats. Mama is saying the blessing, and they have been transitioned to Shabbat very quickly. It's not what I would think of as the Shabbat preparation sequence.
Also wondering why they haven't, I don't know if bathhouses were a thing then.
They were. There was famously a woman who owned a bathhouse on the Lower East Side.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And a Jewish woman too, and she operated a mikveh out of there.
Cool.
I'm actually wondering when the library is used as the transitional sequence, and not, for example, Ella being in charge of taking the girls to the bathhouse.
Which we don't know whether they used the bathhouse.
But yes, pre-Sabbath bathing is a thing I would 100% expect.
Yes, that's right.
And if the carp is in the bathtub, at least not in this sequence, but in other sequences, they probably have to use the bathhouse.
Right. There's just not enough physical time and space. There's not enough physical space to bathe and cook.
Because the bathroom is the kitchen.
Exactly.
Right. If you're going to show them doing pre-Shabbat bathing, whether or not this family in real life use the bathhouse or not, they're in their weekday dresses and
they're in their school clothes. Yeah. They may not have special Shabbat
clothes. They may not have special Shabbat clothes. I was just going to say. But one would assume that they would clean and maybe brush their dresses. There are ways that you could show them preparing that are not them hanging out at the library, which is actually really weird for me.
There is one thing that occurs to me, though, which is significant. It's winter.
Yes.
Sunset in New York in winter is super early.
Right.
But you said it's still like only November, so it's still like in the six-ish department.
Nope. The earliest it gets in New York is the first or second weekends in December.
Yes.
And that's at about 10 after 4.
Yeah, but that's...
By late November, it's already 5 or earlier.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, but the girls are really hurrying.
Depending on what time they get out of school, it's a little surprising that Friday is their library day, even in winter, because this is going to keep happening, that through the winter they're going to be dashing home from the library just in time for candlelighting.
They're probably running from school to the library to home.
I don't know.
I mean, if it's remained consistent, because I went to school in New York, I would say probably... School probably ended about 2 o'clock because the school I went to, we began around 7 so that you could have an after school job. I don't know if this would have been consistent with what they're experiencing, but in this era, absolutely, kids had jobs as delivery people. A lot of kids weren't even in school because they were working, but making school as available as possible, as early as possible, seems like it's something that may have carried over. I would have to do some research on that. So the girls probably have some part of the afternoon to go to the library and probably also to do chores. But ultimately, like, we also see these other sequences where they're in the house in the morning. So it's not really clear when school is happening.
Yeah,
And some of it is that we're also digging down into, like, very nitty gritty and expecting consistency from a piece of fiction that is not necessarily designed to provide it.
Very true. Exactly. Very true. A piece of fiction aimed at children, there is probably a lot of detail that is left out, smoothed over. It's not relevant to the story as we're telling it.
Right. And I'm noticing this now. I definitely didn't, like, literally it occurred to me in the last 2 minutes that why aren't they getting clean? Like, that's a thing they should be doing. But that's something that from my perspective as also to some extent as a parent, as someone, but also somebody who's now been preparing for Shabbat for 38 years, I was not the active preparer of Shabbat when I was first reading these books.
No. Bringing it up, I am reminded, I've brought this up in previous chapters, and I'm going to bring it up again now, another point of comparison between this and the Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder. Is that we got in a couple, not many, but a couple of the earlier books in that series, what it is like for a child in that context. We get it, I think, once for Laura, and we get it once in Farmer Boy for Almanzo, who becomes Laura's husband later. We get this book about his childhood.
Yes.
We get what Sunday is like and what preparing for Sunday is like. What you said, Terry, about this is a time, the Sabbath is a time of peace, but also of rules, was, I think, to Laura and even more so to Almanzo, and with an inner story, even more so to Almanzo's grandfather when he was a kid, way more than I think to most Christian children today, Sunday being a day of rules.
Yes.
Of things that you can't do because it's Sunday. Laura has this little tantrum at one point.
Yes, I remember
because she's like, she's five. She's a little kid. And she is being expected to spend the whole day sitting quietly and not running around and having fun because this is Sunday and Sunday is not a day for running around and having fun. No, you can't cut out dresses for your paper dolls.
Right.
For Almanzo, it's no, you can't whittle on that wooden chain you're making. And it's just the rules becoming oppressive in a way that then their parents in different ways have to deal with getting them through that.
It's interesting that that's not Sydney Taylor's approach.
Exactly. Not we do all. Not have Gertie because she is so little, or Henny because she is a much wilder kid than the others, feeling frustration about the things you can't do because it's Sabbath.
Keeping in mind, though, that we're only seeing the first part of the Sabbath.
That's true. We are seeing Friday night. We're not seeing Saturday. We don't get Havdalah.
Right. This is Havdalah, for those that don't know, is the ceremony that ends the Sabbath. Because we start the Sabbath with wine and fire, we end the Sabbath with wine and fire. So there's a little ceremony we do to like break apart the Sabbath from the rest of the week.
To somebody who has never been exposed to it, Friday night is to some extent the nicest part. And it's the part that does not, that exists in the home. It's been a long time and I haven't even really finished rereading this book, but I don't remember if, other than when they go to the Reform Synagogue, if the girls ever go to shul in these books.
They do for holidays. I do not recall if we ever see them do so for Sabbath.
These books make you want to be there in ways that I never felt with Little House. Maybe to some extent that's because this is my culture and Little House is very foreign to me.
Which is why I think it's so interesting how many similarities there are, is that the cultures are profoundly different. The settings are profoundly different, and yet...
I mean...
I keep finding... There it is.
So, again, haven't reread them in a really long time, but I think there's less casual racism in the All of a Kind Family book.
A little bit less. We talked about that in one of the previous chapters.
And significantly less corporal punishment. Yes, there's at least one or two significant spankings, but it's not on the scale that the Little House books had.
And it's presented with more humor, I think, too.
Yeah.
Because there is that sequence in the future where Papa accidentally spanks the wrong person, mm-hmm. who we'll get to in a later book. But ultimately, yes, the Little House books are more rules than fun. And I would say that these are cast with more fun than
rules.
Yes. Which I don't think is necessarily reflective of the difference between the cultures so much as the difference between the writers' approaches.
Yeah, it's the telling as opposed to the culture.
Yes.
Because, I mean, absolutely, these girls lived in a stiff, starched world, and there was corporal punishment on the table if they stepped out of line. That being said, all four of the parents in those books, right, you've got the Ingalls Wilder parents, and you've got the Brenner family parents, they all have a sense of humor.
It's true.
Even when Pa is really riled up in the Little House books, you know he's not going to really hurt Laura.
Yeah, but, and again, this is very much a difference in the telling. I get love from Mama and Papa in a way that yes. I wouldn't have recognized it when I was reading them for the first time. But certainly knowing the stories as an adult, there is love in that house, in the tenement, that I don't see in the cabin in the woods.
I do, honestly. And I feel like that's probably a whole other discussion.
Oh, sure.
It is.
And again, and maybe some of it is just because I relate to these books on a level, I cannot relate to the Little House book song.
Honestly, legit, because we are all of, if not the same culture, a strongly, strongly related culture.
I am in many, depending on which part of my family line, I am not that removed from this immigrant experience.
Exactly. Yeah,
exactly. Same. I mean, I myself am an immigrant to the States. I am the third generation that immigrated. Like, in each generation, someone immigrated to a different country.
My grandmother was a first generation immigrant. For my grandmother, it happened in Detroit and not in New York.
My mother's parents were St. Louis and not New York, but otherwise, a lot of similarities. And a generation later, still a lot of similarities.
Right.
Whereas we're a split in my family, some of my people came over in this era to Canada, and some of them came over right before the war. And by the war, I mean World War II. So we have a split on that end of it, where we have people from the earlier wave of immigration, we have people from the later wave of immigration, but mostly from a middle wave that doesn't really get documented as much. And because we were coming through Halifax and not through Ellis Island, it's similar, but it isn't the same.
So we have jumped to the end of the chapter with the lovely, lovely Sabbath meal and post-Sabbath meal Friday night calm and peacefulness, and we skipped over a little bit, which is very arc significant, which is that Charlie gets brought up.
Yes.
Yes. And this is a lovely parallel, I think, to the fact that we have these insertions of Miss Allen into the chapter. And even though Charlie isn't present, Ella's very like, oh, is Charlie coming to dinner? Because Ella's still got that crush on Charlie. Mm-hmm. And then everybody has an opinion about Charlie.
Yes.
And Mama kind of refuses to play the opinion game.
You don't ask people about their personal lives. I love that. I love that sense of propriety and respect.
And decorum, right?
Decorum.
This is Papa's best friend.
And if Charlie didn't want to tell you his story, you're not entitled to Charlie's story.
Exactly. Yes.
Exactly. But everyone has an opinion.
I mean, to some extent, Charlie and Miss Allen are the two most different people. Yes, they have their teachers, who are not really brought up in this book, at least not in this half of this book.
We don't hear about them at all, I don't think.
They will get brought up later in other books. We will have significant interactions with different teachers. But most of the adults that these children interact with are like their parents. And yep. Charlie and Miss Allen are so very different from their entire
right,
family.
Because they aren't Jewish.
Because they're not Jewish, because they're not immigrants, because they're just, I don't remember if Miss Allen is supposed to be blonde, but like, they just look different. They look different from everybody they know. So they're going to spend a lot of time thinking about them because they're so different.
Mm-hmm. And they're also, they're young and beautiful, and they're of marriageable age. So in the imaginations of the girls who've been fed on romantic stories, we see that Charlotte reads fairy tales, Ella's reading Dickens. So marriage plots are something that they're all kind of familiar with from storytelling.
That's true, but they don't really seem to be, in contemporary parlance, the kids don't ship them.
No, they're not matchmaking them.
No.
The narrative is matchmaking them, but we don't know that
yet. It's already leading into it.
The narrative ships them hard.
Absolutely.
Very much
so. But the kids don't yet. They're not thinking, wow, we should really introduce Charlie to Miss Allen. I bet they'd get along well, because they belong to very different parts of the girls' lives.
Exactly.
And this is something, because Ella's got that crush, the younger girls are loyal in a way. They wouldn't mm-hmm. think to put Charlie with anybody, because of course they know the way Ella thinks about Charlie.
Do they know? I'm not sure.
These kids are living on top of each other.
I mean, that's true. I bet Sarah knows.
I bet Sarah knows.
I don't know
knows.
About yes. the others, but I bet Sarah knows.
Sarah shares a bed with Ella.
So no, they're not going to look outside the family to set Charlie up, because Charlie's theirs.
Yes.
Right.
Again, in the way that had Charlie, people in my life who I grew up calling aunt and uncle, because we didn't call adults by their first names in...
Not without a title.
Not without a title in my house. So had he been part of my family, he would be Uncle Charlie. And Uncle, there's a possessiveness that the girls have of Charlie.
Yes.
Charlie is ours. We're not going to give him to Miss Allen, because Miss Allen isn't ours in the same way that Charlie is.
Yeah.
Right. And also, it probably doesn't occur to them that Charlie is having whatever he's got going on in his life. They just know Charlie in the context of Papa.
Right.
Charlie is ours. Charlie is Papa's best friend. Charlie is part of our family. Where is Charlie?
Right.
Right? Because like Sarah actually finds herself contemplating, like, who are Charlie's parents? Does he have parents? Is he an orphan? You know, Henny is assuming that Charlie is choosing to go off and explore an adventure.
I guess he likes it this way, she says. And you can tell You can tell that part of her is thinking,
I would.
I'm sure wouldn't mind living in such a way that I could come and go as I liked and no one could stop me.
And I didn't have to live on top of everyone.
Yes.
And Ella is making up a background for him, right? She's taking what she knows and she's trying to like manufacture a life story for Charlie because she's daydreaming about him and she wants to have facts to daydream on.
Yeah.
We've got those different perspectives and Charlotte is just kind of like, huh, Charlie comes and goes. I wonder, there's nobody else in our lives that does that. Like, what is that about?
Why they think about him so much is because he's so very different.
And he's very present also.
He's different from them. He's different from the other peddlers.
Right.
He doesn't fit any standard framing for an adult that they have. They want to know what's his deal.
Because he doesn't exactly. go into a box, they're trying to build the box around him.
Exactly. And because he's so very present with them when he's with them, and he's so very absent from their lives when he's gone, there's that feeling of like, wait, you were right here 10 minutes ago, now you're gone, and I don't know where to find you.
Other than Miss Allen, and Miss Allen doesn't do it to the extent that Charlie does, he's the only adult that engages with them on their level. He's not an authority in their lives, he's a friend.
Yeah.
And in this chapter, we see the beginning of Miss Allen becoming a friend.
Yes, we do.
But Miss Allen is still Miss Allen.
Miss Allen.
She has a specific role. She fits in it. There's no mystery about her.
And she has power over them.
Also that, yes.
She has been gracious in demonstrating it. But the girls are, to some extent, a little afraid because they know...
Respectful, I would say. They're respectful of her authority.
Yes, they're respectful of her authority because Miss Allen can make the library go away. And they don't want that. Whereas Charlie comes, you know, I'm pretty sure at least in one picture, he's like physically on the level of the little girls. And Charlie engages with them as kids. Miss Allen and Charlie are really the only people who let them be children in a way that modern children understand childhood.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mama and Papa have very strict requirements of their children because that's the way they understand parenting.
It's not that there's no room for playfulness in the house. There certainly is. But again, Charlie is a friendly, safe adult who's not on authority over them.
Right.
And that's so good for them.
What it does is if Charlie wasn't there, there would never be a time other than they're starting to with Miss Allen. But if Charlie wasn't there, there would never be any interactions with adults that really allowed them to be children all of the time.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's valuable.
And again, I think you bring back Little House.
Yeah.
You don't get that until the kids start interacting with teachers in Little House.
And teachers have to be very, very strict disciplinarians. You want to talk about corporal punishment.
Yeah,
corporal punishment in the classroom being a thing.
Right.
There is one teacher who is seen as deeply weird because she won't hit the kids.
But with those kids are never, especially when you're talking about like who was the intended audience, by 1950, kids are kids in ways that they were not in 1912.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think that gets emphasized in one of the beginnings of the other chapters is that they say, oh, there's no brook for them to play in. There's not an environment for children. In this era, we actually have I think this is about 10, 15 years later, we have the opening of the first playground on the Lower East Side. And they actually build tenement-shaped dollhouses.
I didn't know that. That's fantastic.
That's amazing. Ah.
Photographs of it. It's really kind of amazing. But that doesn't happen for quite a while at this point.
But you need, if kids are going to engage with it, you need that children being children. And
exactly.
And you also, this is again, a lot of this is just occurring to me right now. You want them to be children in front of adults.
It's good for kids to be able to be kids with adults and not just with other kids. And talking of things just occurring to us now, we have in this first book almost nothing of these girls interacting with other girls their age or other kids their age.
It's all off screen.
Friends are mentioned,
and they go to school.
We hear about it, but we don't see it.
We see it in some of the later books.
Yeah, in the later books.
The first time we get an on-screen friend, we get Guido and we get Grace, but those are the first time we really get on-screen friends who aren't adults.
And there's a bit with Henny hanging out with her friends, or Henny bringing her friends into the house to see the baby in a later book.
Spoiler.
But we have spoilers, sorry. We don't have kids outside of the family on screen in this book at all, I don't think.
No.
That's so odd.
But it is really the girls existing in the world of the adults.
Very much.
And that is something that there's a mentality, absolutely, like of being at home and being with adults versus being at school and being with other kids. And that's the story that Sydney Taylor chose to tell for this book, right? It's the adult world of Judaism, of the Lower East Side, of New York.
And
encompassing this little family.
And again, it's 1912. Childhood as a concept, not really there yet.
The Victorians have it.
Not to the degree that it is later. You have kids being kids. Kids playing with each other out on the streets is absolutely a thing
yes.
in the tenements at this point. I'm thinking again of Everything But Money, which is a book I brought up in a previous chapter. It's a comedian Sam Levinson writing about his childhood in just about this period. And he has whole chapters about street games. There is one crucial difference is that he is
a boy. That's I was just gonna say.
Because we have pictures of girls playing street games, but Mama would never allow it.
Right.
These girls are starched and frilled within an inch of their lives. They're not gonna squat in the street and play marbles.
They're not gonna play stickball. They're not going to play run under the horse's hooves before it can hit you.
And I don't think other girls their age would a large extent.
Depending on where they were being raised and by whom.
Depending on what their parents' approach was.
And how many brothers they had.
That is a big difference. This is a family of daughters. And actually, in this chapter, it is emphasized that the girls and Mama are both very proud of the fact that Mama presents herself well.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's a tiny bit of body shaming there, too, where it's...
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't going to bring that up. I was trying to be nice about it.
I know, but it's right there on the page. And I kept that line in my head for years, thinking, I don't want to turn into a mattress, right? Oh. And then, you know, of course, we all turn into mattresses eventually. That's aging.
And that just makes us comfier.
Exactly. Mama has this proud carriage because she's carrying herself beautifully. Miss Allen does this, too. And I think that that's one of the reasons the girls are so eager to introduce Miss Allen. They're like, here is a woman of Mama's quality that we can introduce her to.
It is obvious that Mama cares enough about it to always look that way and to wear shirt waists and skirts instead of cheap dresses and things like that, because that's what Mama cares about. That's also what the girls are going to care about.
And also what Mama is going to care about in terms of telling her girls how to behave.
Right.
I don't think we ever actually hear Mama tell the girls, I expect you to behave like ladies, but there's something of that in there.
She doesn't have.
I think you're right.
It's heavily implied just by the culture in
right.
the home.
Yeah.
There is an expectation that you will behave a certain way. And some of that has to do with the way that meals are regimented, which will come up later, and the way that behavior is regimented, and the fact that every child has a chore that they're obliged to do.
Absolutely. And also because there's a monetary compensation. And Batya and I talked about this in an earlier episode of the social contract between the parent and the child, which is, if you want your allowance money, you're going to behave according to our strictures, and these are the strictures.
Right.
And every child had that in their brain by the time that they were going to go out and interact with society.
So there's not a whole lot of opportunity. The library is like their special place. That implies that they're not doing a lot of socializing with the other children in the neighborhood.
Or if they are, it's entirely in the context of at school,
right.
And not after school.
I mean, the girls do have friends. Like, it's clear that there are definitely people outside the family who are significant. They're not coming on the page as often as we would expect in a narrative about children. In a contemporary narrative about children, the parents would be eclipsed and the kids would be emphasized. And we've got the opposite. The kids are almost eclipsed by the adults in their world.
Yeah.
Because it's about family. I mean, that's the title of the book.
That's a big thing. Yeah, this is
exactly.
about their family life. And the presence of friends is only important insofar as it affects the family life,
right.
which it hasn't much yet. And it will more as they get older.
Other than the last book, which is in many ways very different from every book that came before it. That's Ella, because it's Ella of All of a Kind Family.
Yeah.
And it is about Ella making vastly different choices than, and we're getting like way ahead. I'm way out over my skis here, but.
You're going to have to come back and for book five.
Oh, yes. Come back for book five if we get to book five.
I would be delighted to come back for book five. I will come back for books two, three, and four.
Recurring guest, Terry Ash.
Yes.
These books are very family-centric. Their friends are always ancillary, and it's always about home and family, and that is the core. And that's why the books are called all-of-a-kind family and more all-of-a-kind family and all-of-a-kind family uptown and all-of-a-kind family downtown.
Title drops. But it's true because you get that expanding wave. Yeah. As we establish characters, we've got this little circle of family. We've got our seven characters, and then we add our peddlers, and then we add our neighborhood, we add our religious figures, we add our extended family, and all of a sudden we have a larger family circle. We haven't even gotten to the uncles and aunts except for Uncle Hyman. And so slowly we're panning out from the family dining room and out into the world. And by the time that we get to books 3 or 4, you can afford to have a couple of chapters that include friends, because everyone knows that the rest of the characters are still baked into the world.
The first novel is very much a setting establishment novel in a lot of ways. Yeah. It's establishing the character of the girls. And frankly, when you have 5 girls, and other than Gertie, who there's not a lot of there because she's not that old.
She's 4.
4-year-olds definitely have independent personality, but when you're in a family of 5, there's rarely a lot of there for the youngest at this point. When you're spending all of this time establishing a whole chapter just on how do these girls spend their allowance money and eat their candy and their cookies.
Yeah, yes. It's a great chapter.
Love it's a great one. Chapter.
A little callback to that chapter when they go into the fish shop.
Yes.
And Charlotte says, let's hold our noses while we're in the fish shop.
And talk to each other with our noses held.
With our noses closed. That whole Charlotte making the rule and Gertie following the rule, which is their dynamic, especially at this point. And later we see them on the Sabbath when everyone else is silently reading. Gertie is quietly reading in the corner with Charlotte reading to her, because Gertie still doesn't read.
There's not that much book. And if you're going to spend all this time establishing the character of 5 girls, there's not a lot of room for friends regardless.
Exactly.
There's just only so many words.
It's true.
Especially because they're inserting this arc plot for a romance, and they already have the characters of Mama and Papa, which are sort of, you have to have Mama and Papa or the story doesn't work. So now you've got 2 more adult characters who are significant. We've got like 11 characters on the page now. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. It's 9. That's not how math works.
That's not how math works. But we will have more characters. Like, we do have recurring characters, shop owners. We've got the uncle, and we're eventually going to have the aunt. So there is definitely that growing sense of like, who are all these people? And we know that Sidney Taylor actually slimmed down the number of aunts and uncles and children in the books to make it more palatable, because you can't have that many people on the screen.
Ensemble casts are hard to work with, and the more characters exactly. you have. So since this is based on real life, deciding who to include and who to leave out was probably a whole thing.
And I mean, we do know that she deliberately conflated some people. I mean, even Charlie and Miss Allen, I think, are actually conflations of people. They weren't real people necessarily. It's taking the story of a romance that happened to like an older neighbor who was friends with one of the girls, and taking that and transferring it to the library lady, so that we have that neat parallelism between Charlie and the library lady.
You're always going to get composites instead of people.
And composites of individuals, and also stories being conflated and edited and dramatized. Because very seldom, not never, but seldom, that things that happen exactly the way they do in real life make for great stories. You put in, what do you take out, is what makes the story work as a story. And sometimes what you have to do, or what you choose to do, to make it an even better story is to fictionalize some aspects. And that's really yes. a big thing of what we've been discussing all through these books, is what gets fictionalized. Terry, thanks so much for joining us. This has been great. I do hope we can get you back for later ones. For our audience, tell us, where can we find you? What, if anything, are you working on right now?
Thank you so much for having me. This has been wonderful. So you can find me on most social media platforms at a very archaic handle that dates back to the days of Ye Olde Live Journal, which tells you just how internet old I am.
Same.
Which is at CREWGRRL at Crew Girl, except on Instagram, where I'm something else, but I hate Instagram, so don't go find me there. My personal website, where you can also purchase me as a wrangler, which is artistwrangling.com. Very complicated. And basically anywhere also that Geek Calligraphy, my other business, lives on social media. And right now I am working on doing all of the 7 million freelancing things that I do, and trying to get some Geek Calligraphy things out before the end of the year. So
tell us more about Geek Calligraphy.
Geek yes. Calligraphy is the art business that I manage, and sometimes was said earlier, professional killjoy. Sometimes I have to say that the idea is not going to work. With my best friend, Ariella Hausman, she is the artist and also a so ferret in other parts of her life. And
that's a female scribe.
Yes, that's a female scribe, which you're not going to find in these books. We do both Judaica and non-Judaica geek-themed wall art, Mary Robinette Cowell. We've worked with Neal Stephenson, and we've worked with Lois McBaster-Bujold, and most recently with Seanan McGuire.
Ooh.
Doing some licensed, really cool licensed work that you can all find at our website, geekcalligraphy.com, and sometimes at science fiction conventions when those are happening, when it is not a plague.
Thank you so much for being here. It's been delightful, and we look forward to having you come back someday.
Indeed.
I'm Merav Hoffman.
And I'm Batya Wittenberg, and we're really glad you're here.
Tune in next time when we'll hear Ella say, "I think we're old enough to buy a present for Papa this year."
Our opening theme music is the public domain Dill Pickle Rag, performed here by Arthur Pryor's band, courtesy of the Internet Archive. Our closing theme music is the La Sirene Waltz, also in the public domain, written by Pietro Dero, performed here by Daniel Gunderson and Sonny Larson. All of a Kind Podcast's logo is by Al Benbow. Please see our full production credits on our website at allofakindpodcast.com.